You are listening to an American Free Press podcast.
Joining me on the line is Dr. Lisa Martino-Taylor, a professor of sociology at St. Louis Community College. Dr. Martino-Taylor, thanks for joining us today.
It's my pleasure.
I read this study online about a week and a half ago, I think, where new documents reveal that Cold War chemical testing was conducted on U.S. neighborhoods. I want to get into that in a minute, but before we do, for the benefit of the listeners, can you just give them a little bit of background about who you are?
Sure. I am a professor of sociology at St. Louis Community College, and I study elite deviance and organizational structures related to companies, to organizations, etc.
Elite deviance, you said?
That's right.
Can you define that?
Sure. That's when acts of crime or deviance are committed by people who are high-ranking or by people who are wealthy in society.
Oh, that's really cool. So these guys who are in jail, I guess, for doing what they did on Wall Street, do you study them?
That would fall under my purview.
Mm-hmm. I never heard of that before. This study was really shocking, and let me just briefly tell the listeners about it, then I'll let you have the floor. But what happened was, I guess, and please correct me if I'm wrong, you had uncovered some documents that showed that the U.S. government during the Cold War, specifically from 1953 to 1954 and from 1963 to 1965, the U.S. government was secretly spraying chemicals in residential neighborhoods in, well, at least one place was St. Louis, Missouri. Is that right?
That's correct.
And the reason that you had uncovered this was because two people that you knew had expressed concerns about their cancer because they were in the area at the time of the spraying, or their family was, and one person brought their concerns to you, and then maybe about a week or two later, another one did. Is that right?
That's right. In fact, one of them was a work colleague, and she was actively fighting breast cancer, and she was the first person who came to me and told me this fantastic story about how she had been sprayed. I could hardly believe it. She said she was on the playground as a child and that she had been sprayed by some unknown chemical. And then a week later, a neighbor came to me and told me the same story, but she knew that it was military related, or she told me it was, and she had had a brain tumor 10 years prior to this, and she was concerned that her brain tumor was connected to the spray event.
The first one that you mentioned, was that the person who was playing baseball and the plane came down low and dropped the powder on her and then she went in and cleaned up and came back out?
No. She was a little girl. She was playing on the playground at school. In fact, both of them were. And neither of these people knew each other, by the way. But they had told me the same story, which was why it was so really difficult to believe. But it stayed with me. I found it really troubling. And I also found it troubling that I found very little information out about it. It seemed as if it really had never occurred until I started requesting documents through the Freedom of Information Act.
When did they actually come to you with their concerns? Do you remember when that was, what month and year?
This was in probably the late 1990s.
Did you start filing the FOIAs back then?
No. What happened initially was they both asked me if I knew anything about it, and I did not. And I had to admit that. So they were very gracious about it when I told them that I didn't know anything about it and I didn't find out very much about it. I'd seen maybe one mention very briefly in a newspaper article about it, and that was it. And then we just all sort of moved on with our lives. But when I entered a doctoral program and when I was getting ready to write my doctoral dissertation, I decided that it was time to look into this.
Why do you think they came to you just by chance? Because you're a professor of sociology, right?
I wasn't at the time, but I did research related to toxins and people exposed to toxins in communities. And so they knew, particularly my colleague, knew the type of work that I did as far as research topics professionally. And so she, I guess, felt that I would be a good person to ask.
When did you actually start working on it then?
4 to 5 years ago, I started really digging into this.
And what you uncovered was that this wasn't unique because there was something called Operation Large Area Coverage.
Yeah, Operation Large Area Coverage was a little different. However, this wasn't part of Large Area Coverage. That actually was high altitude spraying, where they claimed that there were biological stimulants that they're releasing from airplanes. And the St. Louis study was quite different from that one. This involved ground spraying and spraying from rooftops. It was also highly secretive. There were minority populations that were targeted in the St. Louis study. It was much more concentrated because it was on the ground. And there was a cover story that had been provided by the military to deceive people in St. Louis.
That was nice of them. And they were also spraying from, I guess, school rooftops and also spraying from, like, station wagons as they drove through the neighborhoods. Is that right?
Right. right. They affixed blower generators to vehicles, and they drove through neighborhoods and just sprayed it morning, noon, and night.
It's something out of a movie. When I read that, I thought to myself, is this real? But it actually did happen. Crazy. The component that they were spraying, I guess, in Operation Large Area Coverage, and this one was something called zinc cadmium sulfide, right?
Well, that's what the Army later claimed that they sprayed was zinc cadmium sulfide. They didn't say that at the time. They said this later. But according to the National Research Council, over a ton of this material was sprayed just in that later series between 1963 and 1965. So it's an awful lot of this. Now, cadmium is problematic in that it's been linked in the literature. And at the time that they did this study, it was also linked in the literature to kidney disease and chronic lung disease. And today we know that it's a probable human carcinogen, a cancer-causing agent. There's also strong lines of evidence that there's a radiological component to the St. Louis studies. And I kind of fleshed this out in my research and looked at the people who were involved in radiological weapons testing that came out of the Manhattan Project. And this St. Louis study seems to be tied to this Manhattan Project and larger military goals at that time.
Right. And of course, the Manhattan Project was the joint U.S.-UK and Canadian R&D program that began in 1939 to create an atomic bomb. Cadmium, you said, now, today, it's a known toxin. What about back then? Do you think they knew it?
Well, they should have known it because it was in the literature since the 1800s that it caused chronic lung disease and kidney disease. They certainly would have had access to the literature. I mean, there are hundreds of studies that affirmed human toxicity for cadmium at that time.
Yeah, so they can't claim ignorance, right, in the 1800s. And in the zinc cadmium sulfide, in your study, you also suspect that there might be some radium that was in it, right?
That's correct.
And radium is not good because it's an unstable element, right? It's constantly breaking down.
It's a radioactive isotope. There are strong lines of evidence that there was a radiological component to this study, whether it's radium or whether it was some other isotope. I'm not exactly sure. But I do know that given the larger military project from this, what I call the Manhattan-Rochester Coalition, which was this spin-off or offshoot from the Manhattan Project, that they had a large national goal to develop radiological weapons. Part of that involved a smaller group within the Manhattan Project, a group of scientists who did a number of different studies to that end to test radiological components. And that included injection studies, which they did do, injecting people with radioactive plutonium in Oak Ridge, Tennessee, and in Nashville. They did ingestion studies. And again, they did do these with strontium-90, which involved children. And all of this is without consent or knowledge. And then they had the desire to do inhalation studies, and evidence is highly suggestive that this was their urban inhalation component that they wanted to do. And they talked about this. There were memorandums exchanged about doing such studies, and in fact, they began with animals, doing exposure to radioactive materials with inhalation with animals. And then what they wanted to do was target an urban population. And St. Louis was the Army's top choice as far as closest matches Stalingrad and Moscow. So we can't rule out a radiological component given this context of this larger project.
And again, you mentioned that it was predominantly low-income areas where they sprayed, and it was predominantly people of color. And is this correct? 70% were children under the age of 12?
In the Pruitt-Igoe area, 70% in that housing district were children under 12. And I can tell you, I pulled apart the census data. No one had ever done that before. No one had ever really looked that closely at the St. Louis studies. It was always sort of thrown in with all of these other studies, but it was quite unique. They definitely targeted poor minority neighborhoods. They called it, quote, a densely populated slum district. That's what the Army called it. One of the areas called the Howe area was 78% black population in this area that was most targeted. So it's in their records that they were targeting a poor minority community. They were purposeful in their selection of areas to be targeted for the spraying.
You could actually determine if there was a radiological component based upon the side effects that these people are experiencing. Would you be able to work backwards from there?
Well, I'm not an epidemiologist. The focus of my study actually was on how a study of this nature could be done given the organizational structure, which was quite sophisticated, given the layers of secrecy, which was quite extensive, and the layering, the embedded studies, which was studies within studies. They were able to do this type of series of tests over two decades. So that was really the focus of my study. You know, I'm not an epidemiologist, so I can't tell you anything about what health effects might show up today. I hope that there are not people who have health issues, but I can tell you that there are concerns in the community about spraying that took place.
And the Army did admit that it added a fluorescent substance, but whether or not it was radioactive remains classified, right?
Right, and I was unable to get all the documents that I wanted. I really had to fight to get the documents that I did. In one case, I had to appeal to a Supreme Judge advocate to get them. And some of the documents that I was able to obtain, I'm not able to release. We do know that United States Radium produced this fluorescent powder and that they had produced a radioactive fluorescent powder decades earlier that killed a number of young women in their facility. And so that's the company that manufactured this fluorescent powder that was sprayed here in St. Louis.
Right, the Radium Girls. That was, of course, in New Jersey.
And
Right, and they would lick their paintbrushes.
Right, but actually what happened with the Radium Girls was they were actually inhaling radium. And the health reports, the government reports that came out after that, noted that these young women were inhaling radium, this 226 material that they were using. Now, FP2266 was the material that was sprayed in the St. Louis studies.
And you mentioned just a minute ago that it was a struggle getting these FOIA documents and that some of them that you have, you're not allowed to release. Is that what you said?
That's right. Some of the documents that I got, I am unable to even copy or reproduce in any way, let alone share. So they've kept quite a tight lid over five plus decades over the St. Louis studies. Some of these documents were declassified at my request when I requested them. But they didn't declassify everything, and there's still plenty of things that we don't know about this, and there are a lot of important questions to continue to ask.
I thought once you get the documents that they're yours, you can do whatever you want with them. So they're basically telling you, look, you can see it, but you can't let anybody else see it?
Right. I received documents and I was notified that I cannot copy or reproduce some of the documents that I have. I made my doctoral dissertation open to the public. It's open access. Anyone can access it as long as they have internet access. But some of the documents I'm prevented from sharing with the public. I wanted everything to be in the public domain, but we don't always have the ability to do that. There's not full transparency. And this brings to the front a need for transparency, that we have some issues here related to transparency. Even though we have laws to protect people, events such as this happen, even though we have laws that say we have a right to documents, we don't have a right to all documents. We sort of have to balance secrecy with transparency, and so there are other issues at play here.
They threatened you that if you did release it to other people that you could, I don't know what, go to jail?
That's a violation of federal law.
So they're just trusting you that you're not going to do it under the threat of prosecution. Okay, I didn't know about that. That's great. And Missouri Senators Roy Blunt and Claire McCaskill have asked the Army Secretary, John McHugh, for more information in a letter demanding answers. Have they gotten anything? Have you heard about that?
I don't know. You know, it could be, this is a very compartmentalized study, that even within the Manhattan Project, the Manhattan-Rochester Coalition, the small group that did these human studies, these human induction, ingestion, and inhalation studies, this small group, the larger project, the other scientists on the Manhattan Project may not have even have known about this smaller group. It was that compartmentalized. The same thing in the St. Louis study. We know that there were people that were engaged in doing different components of the St. Louis study that may not have known that this was an Army study. In fact, some people came forward to say this. And so we know that portions of the St. Louis study were classified and that they were using classified material. They were using security-cleared personnel. They were using an off-site lab that was secure. And so that there were certain parts of it that were being conducted here in St. Louis where more people knew about. But then there were these embedded studies where they were highly secret, fewer people knew about it, and that seemed to be a part here of the St. Louis study. And this isn't the first time. It's happened in other military studies. We also know that even in one conference, that even their invitations were classified, that they had to return those to a P.O. box to be destroyed. So there are some really interesting things going on here as far as secrecy and classification and embeddedness.
When you were doing this study, and right now, were you a little nervous or were you scared? Are you scared of what you uncovered?
When you undertake this kind of scholarship, I think it's important to ask these tough questions, to look at claims, and sometimes scholarship has to be hard-nosed, and sometimes public inquiry has to be persistent. So I just think it's a matter of asking really difficult questions and looking with some scrutiny at claims and trying to distinguish claims from facts, and that's the nature of scholarship sometimes.
When I originally read about this, it was from a website, I guess, from a local paper over there where you're at in Missouri. And I guess you were interviewed by a couple of other sources, and at least one of them, it seemed, was the mainstream media. Have you gotten any more coverage after the news broke, or is that it?
It's gotten a lot of media attention. I've also been contacted by a number of people from around the country who grew up in the area who said that they have certain memories and that they're concerned about their health. And I think that they, too, now have a lot of questions, and this is kind of open-ended. open-ended in that there are an awful lot of questions for some folks to answer here. And I hope that we get some really good answers. I hope that we get some public hearings about this and that we find out a lot more. I hate to think that we don't find out more. We know that there was the desire to do radiological studies. We know that there was an organizational structure in place to do it, and they had the capability to do it in secrecy. And so all of that presents itself through my research here, and I think that this opens up a lot more questions.
I did spend quite a bit of time on your 838-page dissertation. Any chance of you putting that in book form?
Yeah, I'll be working on a manuscript and hopefully get that out sometime soon.
Dr. Lisa Martino-Taylor, sociology professor at St. Louis Community College, I want to thank you for the time you spent explaining all this to listeners, and I want to thank you for your study. It's terrific, and you really can write. Let me say that. I was enthralled after reading the dissertation, and of course, about 500 or 600 pages of it are documents that you uncovered, but I really enjoyed your writing style, and thanks again for coming on the show, and thanks for taking the time out.
It's been my pleasure.